This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The domestic cats who share homes with so many of us are descended from shy, solitary North African wildcats, and they've had to learn over time how to talk to us. But how well do we understand what our cats' meows and other signals really mean? A new book called The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow, seeks to translate those messages for us. And cat lovers out there might be surprised about what they've been misinterpreting. Joining me now in this recorded interview is the author of The Hidden Language of Cats, cat behavior scientist Sarah Brown. Welcome to the program, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Oh, it's such a delight. Your book, The Hidden Language of Cats, is based on years and years of research and study of cats, but it also includes some really interesting insights about other animals, especially dogs. I'd like to start by asking you to explain the challenges that cats faced to adapting to life with humans as compared to the challenges that dogs faced.
Yes, of course. So, yeah, cats, I think many people don't realize perhaps that cats are descended from a solitary ancestor, the North African wildcat, which mainly communicated via scent. They very rarely encountered each other on a day-to-day basis, so they would leave scent marks, and still do, the current wildcats, leave scent marks for others to pick up later. And compare that to dogs, which evolved from wolves, which were social animals, lived in packs, and they inherited this amazingly established full repertoire of social signals that dogs then just, you know, brought into their lives with humans. So cats have had to work really hard at learning how to communicate up close with one another and with people, because they, you know, they couldn't just use scent once they got up close to another cat. So they developed more visible and tactile up close signals. So it's quite a challenge. They've had to work much harder at it, I think, than dogs have.
Yeah, and you write that sometimes some of the things that our cats do with us, some of the smelly things they do, or maybe a way that they're trying to communicate with us. Talk about that in terms of marking and spraying and some of the unpleasant things that cats do sometimes that people may misinterpret.
Yeah, absolutely. So even though they developed all these new signals, scent is really, really important to cats still. It's their sort of go-to method of communication. And take, for example, scratching, which we think of as just a functional behavior, which just to sort of maintain their claws, get the outer husks of their claws off. But actually, when they scratch, it serves as a social signal for them, because they deposit little scent marks from the glands between their toes. And so every time they scratch, they leave another bit of scent on the post or whatever they're scratching, which is really important for the cat to feel comfortable in its home and in its environment, to reinforce that smell. Similarly, when they rub on a doorpost or any part of the house that you see them rubbing on, you might gradually see over time where they repeatedly rub a sort of slightly smudgy dark mark, and that is a deposit from the scent glands on their cheeks, which you know collects over time and is another sort of reassuring scent mark for them.
And I know you wrote in your book that even when a cat does something unpleasant like spraying, it could be a signal to that, hey, there was another cat outside that's scaring me, or there's another animal that's maybe getting in the cat door at night. I mean, what are some of the things cats do that their people might think this cat's just trying to torture me, when they're really trying to send you a message?
Yeah, so spraying in particular upsets a lot of people, not surprisingly, because it's quite smelly and unpleasant. But the cats tend to do that when they're stressed or they're trying to, you know, make a point, trying to reinforce their smell in their environment. And it's usually when there's something's changed. There's a cat, like you said, they can see another cat outside, or some other cat has invaded their territory, or something new has come into the home. They don't like change. And so if some, you know, new furniture comes in, or there's redecoration, or just anything that's out of ordinary, they may get very stressed. And if that stress reaches a certain level, they may start to spray on that object or near the object, or just generally around the house. And so what we think of as an unpleasant behavior is actually just a natural reaction to stress for them. Mm.
And humans obviously have a far less refined sense of smell. So talk about what cats have had to learn to try to get our attention.
Yeah, so I think they have cottoned on, luckily, that we just don't really get all these very subtle scent marks they're leaving on our, on our door frames and scratch posts. So they've developed the meow is probably the most iconic way of getting our attention that we know about. They seem to have worked out that we as a species communicate by vocalization, and then that's the best way to get a person's attention is to make a noise. And so, although they don't really meow much to each other, they have learnt to meow, often and loudly to people. And so, yes, that's one way. Tail postures they use as well to try and get our attention, which we may notice, but probably the meow is the most effective way of getting our attention.
What about the way they kind of rub against people, against someone's legs, or kind of do a little head butt? How has that developed over time, and how should people decode those kinds of signals?
Yeah, so rubbing is another interesting one because they do that to each other as well. So if you observe a colony of cats, which is what I did for my studies years ago, I watched groups of feral cats and they would rub on each other. And it's thought that they rub on each other partly to exchange scent, but also because they actually quite like the tactile experience of rubbing on each other. It's a very bonding behavior. And that's a similar thing that they're doing with us. So they just rub on us on our legs like they would on another cat. And part of that might be to, like I say, get the bonding behavior and the tactile experience, but also sometimes just to get our attention, because they also know that if they nudge us, we'll look down and they'll tell us what they want some other way.
Yeah.
So yes.
It's so sweet. And some of them, I have a cat who will rub his nasty gums right against my nose. And I mean, is he
Oh,
trying to treat
lovely.
me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't mind because I love him so much. But is he trying to say, hey, I think you're another cat? Or is he just desperate to get my attention with his stinky breath?
I think he's probably trying to do a bit of both. I think he's trying to, show affection, but also maybe trying to, scent mark on you a bit as well with his toothy gums.
You mentioned tail positions, and you go into quite a bit of detail about tail positions in your book, which I thought was so interesting. I've always called that alert, kind of very upright tail, a happy tail on a cat. What have you learned about what cats' tail positions mean with when they're communicating with each other and when they're trying to communicate with their less well-informed people?
Yeah, so I love tail positions because it's one of the things that I studied a lot when I was watching the colonies that I watched. And I watched two colonies of cats and wrote down basically everything they did to each other for quite a long time, and then analysed all the behaviours they used in their interactions. And one of the most interesting and important behaviours they used in their interactions was this tail up signal, where they raised their tail into a vertical position. And I discovered that when one cat approached another with its tail up like that, it was very unlikely that any hostile or unpleasant behaviour would follow. It was normally followed by rubbing or sitting together and grooming. Whereas if they approach with their tail down, just lowered or hanging down, the outcome of interactions was much more mixed. So tail up was really a sign of, I come in peace. I'm approaching to be friendly, and they use that with us too. You see them, when they greet you when you come home, and they run up to you with their tail up, sometimes quivering with excitement. It's the same, friendly greeting behavior. But as we know, when you see a cat with its tail twitching, that can be much more sort of mixed emotions, getting a little bit anxious or a little bit fed up or irritated at whatever's going on around, and that can progress to thrashing side to side, which can be, a good sign that it's a good time to stop whatever you're doing near the cat.
I think that's something that dog people get confused about with cats, because with don't you? I mean, I'm
Yes.
wholeheartedly a cat person, but I also love dogs. But a dog wagging its tail means something very different than a cat moving its tail in a way that a dog person would think of as wagging, right?
Yeah, this is a great example of two species that have a similar behavior that means the complete opposite in each species. So yes, as you say, a wagging tail in a dog is a happy behavior. A greeting behavior, if you like. And whereas in a cat, it's not good news normally. It's normally, keep away from me, I'm angry. And what's really interesting is when you get cats and dogs living together and they have to learn this, this cross species behavior, and amazingly they seem to work it out, which I think is stunning, really, that they can do that, that a dog can work out that, that wagging tail is something I need to avoid. And with other behaviors too. So, for example, dogs like to sniff each other at the back end, whereas cats quite often just like to greet each other and smell each other's noses. I call it touch noses. And so, dogs quite in living in house with a cat have to learn that actually it's more polite to approach from the front and touch noses.
That's pretty
And they learn that
impressive.
too.
Yeah. They
Yeah.
almost have to be trilingual, right? They have to understand their people. They have
Exactly.
to understand cats, other dogs, and vice versa.
They have to speak human, cat, and dog. Yes.
That's a lot to learn. I couldn't do it. I want to remind our listeners we're talking in this recorded interview about the new book, The Hidden Language of Cats, and how to better understand what our cats are trying to tell us. You also talk about in your book how cats, like dogs, were welcomed into human communities because of the help they could provide people. For cats, of course, it was pest control. How long did it take for humans to start enjoying cats for their company instead of simply their hunting skills?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's quite a hazy sort of area, because we know that wild cat relationship, where they crept into our sort of settlements and farm communities, was about 10,000 years ago, where they became useful to us for controlling the rodents in our grain stores, where we started to store our grain. And so, yeah, farmers started to think that wildcats were quite useful, and wildcats used to, work out that farmers were quite useful. And somewhere we think that the braver ones, would have ventured into the farmers' homes and presumably had kittens, cute little kittens that the families would have then tamed and, adopted. And slowly, by a sort of process that they call self-domestication, if we feel like the cats gradually became part of our lives. And that's the sort of hazy story. But we know that, in Egypt, by about 3,500 years ago, that they were very much, in a more domestic situation. Cats, you have pictures of cats sitting under chairs and on people's laps, and they looked much more like pets than wild cats. So somewhere between 10,000 years ago and 3,500 years ago, they crept into our homes. And but that might have been a more sort of flexible process, where they, some came in, and then we would have mated again with wild cats and then become less tame. So it's a bit of a wishy-washy story, but they definitely did it, and they definitely came into our homes and made themselves welcome.
Well, you have such an interesting part of your book that talks about cats in Egyptian society and how they were revered and worshipped, but also some pretty terrible things happened to cats in ancient Egypt, didn't they?
That's right. So they were worshipped, and for that reason, they were needed as sacrifices to the goddesses. And so this dreadful sort of trade began of breeding wild cats, not wild cats, well, they were wild cats, in solely for the purpose of sacrificing them as offerings to the goddesses, which is odd, because it's in complete juxtaposition to these adored, worshipped cats in people's homes. It's almost like they were a different sort of species that were being kept in these catteries, but they weren't. They were the exact same animals. They were just being bred and bred and bred, and then mummified and sacrificed to the goddesses, poor things.
Brutal. Cats have had a rough way to go in a lot of
They have.
ways. Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things I want to get back to the happier points in your book, you also explain how most cats like to be approached and like to be pet or stroked. And I think this is where a lot of non-cat people go wrong when it comes to their initial interactions with cats. Walk us through that. What's the best way to approach a cat? And if you do get permission from the cat to pet it, how's the best way to do that?
Yes. So, one study of interactions between humans and cats has shown that if you let the cat start the interaction, it will last longer than if you start it. So, the cat likes to start the interaction and let them lead is sort of the message from that. They like to be in control. So, so it's okay to speak to the cat and encourage it to come towards you. And if it looks interested, offer a hand for it to sniff and maybe keep your fingers curled under so it knows that there's something to sniff. And then if it approaches and sniffs, just let it do that for some time. Let it sniff as long as it wants, because that's how it's getting all its information about you. Don't start petting it straight away or go diving in there. Wait until it seems receptive and ready. And often it'll rub on you first, and that's your sort of cue to pet it back. And when you're petting, be very conscious of where you're petting the cat. So most cats prefer to be stroked around the head, around its chin and under the chin and around the ears, rather than the other end, the tail, or their belly, even though some people tell me their cats love to have their belly tickled. It's not always a good place to go, especially if you don't know the cat. And then when you're interacting with it, observe the cat's body language whilst this interaction is going on. Notice whether it might have had enough. So they start to flick their tail or just stop rubbing or even try to move away or start grooming. It might suggest it's time to just stop for now. And I think my advice would be to stop whilst it's still, whilst the interaction is still going well. And then they're more likely to come back for more later.
That makes sense. You mentioned the belly, and I know that's very controversial because there are some cats who will roll over and show you their belly. And a lot of people, and I will say this, I don't mean to sound like I'm biased in this way, especially dog people, will reach down and try to rub that cat's belly. And what I've always heard is that's the cat saying, I trust you, I'm showing you my belly. It's not an invitation to just rub all over it. What have you learned about that? Okay.
Exactly that. So yes, it's sort of the ultimate demonstration of trust. I'm completely relaxed. I trust you completely. I'm going to roll over and show you my belly. And then because dogs love to have their belly tickled most of the time, people do just go in there and it's quite hard to resist and tickle their tummy. And quite often that results in a clamped hand with claws around it because they don't like that invasion of space.
Yes. Understandable. How young should kittens be when they first start getting socialized with humans?
Yes, so this is hugely important. And for many years, people didn't know that there's this very short window of time called the socialization period between 2 and 7 weeks old, where kittens have to be handled by people in order to grow up comfortable around and friendly towards people later in life. And this handling should include as many people as possible, ideally a mixture of adults, children, men and women, for up to an hour a day to get them used to as many different types of people and sorts of interaction as they can. And those kittens will grow up then trusting people, whereas kittens that miss out on this will often grow up more fearful of people as adults, and those are the ones that sadly often become feral or just very withdrawn from people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really enjoyed the part of your book that discusses cats' personalities. I think a lot of people who haven't spent time around cats don't think about personalities in cats. First, what advice would you give people who are looking to adopt a friendly kitten or cat? And secondly, you address this in your book, people have such strong feelings about coat color and what that says about a cat's personality. What does the research show about that?
Yeah, so to start with the coat color, there are many long-standing associations between a cat's coat color and its supposed personality that have sort of gained ground over the years. So orange cats, for example, seem to be universally loved. You know, this goofy, charming, charismatic, the Garfields of the cat world, if you like. And tortoiseshell cats, or a calico, I think you call them more than that, have more of a reputation for being feisty. They get, you know, they get accused of having tortitude or being naughty torties, and you know, it seems a little unfair. And then there's black cats, which have the toughest time of all getting adopted, because they have this long-standing association with witches and evil back from the Middle Ages when they were persecuted. And yeah, they've had a hard time shaking that off. And also black cats apparently in the modern day world are harder to take photographs of, which I find really sad. And that's sometimes a reason that people don't want to adopt them. So anyway, there's all these, you know, associations with coat colour that don't seem to have a lot of scientific background. They're just, you know, sort of myths and traditions that have carried on. So I think there are many things that affect a cat's personality, but I wouldn't go by coat colour if I was trying to find a friendly cat. Some of the factors that affect the personality are genetic. So, you know, to look at the parents, if you know the parents of the cat, the mother and the father, and particularly the father, studies have shown that the personality of the father determines how bold their kittens will be. So, you know, a bold father will have bold kittens. So if you know what the father's like, that's a good indication. But probably the most important factor is what I was just talking about, is the kitten's early experience. So find out as much as you can about how much handling it's had, you know, what sort of home it was in, if it grew up in a home, or if it's in a shelter, you know, what experiences has it had, and spend some time with it. It's very hard to tell with a kitten how friendly it's going to be, because, you know, like a child, their personality grows with them. So if you're really looking for a specific personality, often it can be a good idea to adopt an older cat, or just an adult cat. It doesn't have to be an old cat, but one that's already, you know, where the personality is established, and you can see, okay, this is what they're like. Because all kittens are cute and they all run around.
Yeah. Do you believe cats pick their people? You have a really touching story in your book about a little girl and a cat named Ginny.
Thank you. Yeah, no, I do. I do sometimes think that. I think, you know, you think you can predict so many things about personality types of the cat and personality types of the person. And as it says in my book, I worked in rescue and trying to match people up, prospective cat owners with new cats in the shelter. And you could get an idea of the sort of, you know, sort of cat that would match what that person wanted. But then there are just the times where you just see cats pick their person, and it's just something intangible that happens, and they, you know, some sort of magic happens, and the cat thinks, oh, this is my person.
Yeah.
So yes, I do think that. I mean, not always, but sometimes that does happen.
If you're very lucky.
If you're very lucky, yes.
Well, I've been talking with author and cat behavior scientist Sarah Brown. Her latest book, The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow, is available now. Thank you so much for your time today, Sarah. It has been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.